Hello and welcome to another episode of South Asia Chat, the weekly podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Ramita Iyer, research analyst at ISAS and the host for today's episode. In this edition, we will be looking at the trade and economic outlook for South Asia this year. And we have with us our resident expert, Dr. Amitendu Palit, Senior Research Fellow and Research Lead of Trade and Economics at ISAS. Dr. Palit, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you so much. My pleasure, Ramita.
So the World Bank and the UN projections for 2024 show that South Asia is set to grow somewhere between 5.2 to 5.6% this year. While this is slightly lower than the region's growth both in 2022 as well as the pre-pandemic days, there is a sense that the growth numbers are commendable given the overall global economic slowdown that we're currently experiencing. Could you share your thoughts on these numbers and whether they are sufficient to reach the region's developmental goals?
I guess the first point to be noted on this, Ramita, is that, as you mentioned, we are still not out of a post-pandemic curve. And post-pandemic, the character of global growth and regional growth has been quite uneven. So initially, there was a fairly strong rebound that came after the first year of COVID. Then thereafter, there was a settling down of the momentum. But today, what we are seeing is that the uniformity in growth patterns across the world is no more there. There are episodic periods of growth that are happening in different parts of the world. But the major economies of the world are unfortunately not being able to provide that momentum to global growth. And foremost among them is, for example, China, which has slowed down considerably given its trend rate of growth. And we are also not seeing encouraging growth coming out from the G7. So to that extent, among the major emerging markets of the world, an economy like India and perhaps regional economies like Indonesia on one side, Mexico on the other side, are showing some signs of growth. And taken as a region, South Asia is looking to be positioned on a reasonably good growth trajectory. Though I must say that 5.2% or 5.6% for the region as a whole are not exactly very flattering numbers. This is keeping in mind the fact that we are talking about a region which is home to the largest population of the world, and a considerable part of that population is still fighting with very low incomes and poverty and absence of livelihoods. And the kind of economic growth that is required to take them out of these low levels is going to be much, much more than what we are talking about. So while this is not a bad piece of news, it is probably not the piece of news which would have been taken as reassuring by the policymakers in these countries.
So I want to delve a bit deeper into the drivers of growth within the region. So looking at the various countries in South Asia, while broadly they're all developing countries, we see that they're pretty unequal in terms of their stages of economic development, but also the broader economic realities driving their policies. So are we looking at uniform contribution by the individual countries in the region, or are there some larger countries like India that are playing a bigger role?
India, given the fact that it is almost, I would say, 4/5 of the regional economy, India's performance becomes very fundamental in this regard. The good part is that India did register a very striking rate of contraction followed by an equally striking rate of recovery in the first 2 years of the decade. But then subsequently, there has been moderation. But nonetheless, that moderation continues to remain at a level which is a reasonably strong rate of growth, but it can be better. What is happening elsewhere in the region is a little bit unfortunate, because we see that there are countries which are struggling with their macroeconomic conditions. Pakistan, the second largest economy of the region, is not experiencing the best of economic fortunes. Sri Lanka has steadied the ship to some extent, but it is yet to turn the corner. So is the condition with Nepal. So that leaves us with Bangladesh, which till now appears to be doing reasonably well. And after the conclusion of general elections, there is a reaffirmation of the political continuity, so which should be growth for economic growth to continue. On the whole, however, it seems that the way these countries will perform will depend to a very large extent upon their ability to stay connected between themselves and with the rest of the world. Because by themselves, their source of growth internally will perhaps not be good enough to push themselves in that direction, which is a desirable direction. The good part, of course, is in some respect a point that we often overlook, that all these economies of South Asia have considerably large informal sectors. And those informal sectors are capable of producing fairly surprising economic performances, but then those should not be taken for certain. And on the whole, the internal connections as well as connections with the rest of the world become very significant in driving not just individual rates of growth, but the overall regional rate of growth.
Moving on to the issue of investments, which is considered to be an important driver in ensuring sustainable economic development. So when you look at the region, could you share your views on what kind of investments are coming in, what have been the trends, and who have been the beneficiaries of this?
The investment scenario, I think, needs to be looked at from the perspective of both the long-term and more lasting foreign investment, what we typically refer to as foreign direct investment coming into these countries, as opposed to the ones which are more short-term and perhaps fluctuating in character. Now, for example, if you look at India, the Indian capital markets have been performing very robustly. And the kind of gains that have been experienced by the Bombay Stock Exchange or the Nifty have been quite remarkable. They have posted very large gains. The market capitalization has expanded heavily, which points to the fact that as far as a section of the global portfolio investors are concerned, they are clearly looking at India as a market which is a good market for short to medium term returns. But this cannot be taken as something which can be applied equally well to the long-term investment. When we look at long-term investments that have been coming into the region for a country like India, there are perhaps good examples, like for example that of Apple, which is now very keen and demonstrating its interest in setting up a very large part of the iPad, iPhone 15 manufacturing system and assembling in India. So kind of bringing in the whole ecosystem into the production. There are also some industries which are capable of generating long-term investment potential, particularly in the area of employment. For example, aircraft, defense manufacturing, so on and so forth, which are coming in. But there's a key to understanding this process. I think we need to look at the flow of investment from the point of view of not just they're coming in the sense of bringing in money, but also by what extent are they capable of generating the next generation of benefits? Are they actually employment generating? Are they actually technology creating? Unfortunately, that's not always the case. So, for example, when we look at big investments that are coming into cutting edge areas, for example, green and hydrogen investments, they may not immediately be benefit yielding as far as employment is concerned. In contrast, if there are investments that are coming into areas of, let us say, hospitality and tourism and so on and so forth, they show a greater tendency of employing. And we are, of course, looking at the larger prospects of more investment coming into India, Bangladesh, as they change their characters up the value chain. The point over here is that from a long-term investor's perspective, not the whole of South Asia is actually open for sustainable long-term returns. That confidence is still missing. Perhaps that amount of investments are not going to flow into Sri Lanka. Pakistan continues to remain differently managed and there are tensions. So it's down to India, Bangladesh and probably Nepal to some extent to attract these flows. But not all these countries are equally able to satisfy that assurance that needs to go out to long-term investors. Look, that if you come in, you're going to stay put and you're not going to be disappointed.
Another aspect is that of trade and connectivity. And it has been recently forecasted that global trade volumes are going down. We've also been experiencing supply chain fragmentation as well as unexpected developments like the recent crisis in the Red Sea, where it's become fairly clear that global trade patterns are being increasingly influenced by geopolitics. In fact, a recent UNCTAD report, so this is the UN Conference on Trade and Development, they noted that there has been an overall decrease in the diversification of trade partners. How are these developments likely to affect the growth prospects for South Asia?
I think it's interesting that you mentioned this point, Ramita, because there's a fundamental change that's happening in the way countries are trading with each other. Till about two and a half to three years ago, there was this view that supply chains have been enormously disrupted following the COVID-19 pandemic, which is a fact. And many of the supply chains are critical supply chains, so as to say, which impact the national interests and securities of countries in food, energy, pharmaceuticals, semiconductors, so on and so forth. And the reason for their disruption was actually traced back to their vulnerabilities that arise from concentration in sourcing patterns. So we have seen multi-country efforts from that point in time coming in the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework and other frameworks developing, which have tried to safeguard supply chains. What we see as a result of that is that it hasn't really expanded sourcing, but it has led to sourcing getting concentrated among a few partners. So this is diversification of a very different kind that is happening. This is not exactly the kind of diversification that the world witnessed in the 1980s and 1990s subsequent to economic globalization, when it was a much broader and widespread horizontal diversification. Now it seems that trade and sourcing and supply chain management is getting confined to only a select set of partners, which is predetermined according to geopolitics. And this, you alluded to the UNCTAD report. I think the report rightly mentions that while this pattern is going to last, it is perhaps going to lead a reduction in the overall volume of trade across the world, which is unfortunate. I mean, that's something which could have been avoidable. But the question is that, is there a way of turning back from this? I honestly think no, because when we look at the choices that the countries are making geopolitically, it's pretty much clear that trade with quote-unquote like-minded partners has become the order of the day, and this is the shape that global trade is going to take. South Asia is also moving in that direction. We have seen India making strategic choices in this regard, and perhaps there are other countries which are going to become more framework-oriented in their decisions. For example, we have seen Sri Lanka applying for the membership of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. There are, free trade agreements like that between China and Maldives, which are going to pick up very soon. Now, all these, to some extent, have a geopolitical understanding at their back and in the way they perform. So South Asia will not be able to stay disconnected from this trend. And to that extent, there will be implications from the way countries trade in the region between themselves and with the rest of the world.
So beyond trade and investments, another important factor for South Asian economic growth is remittances. So the region has the highest inward remittance for any region in the world. In 2023, this amounted to about $860 billion, which was a 3% increase from the previous year. And we have been seeing a year-on-year increase for the last 3 years. Given the geopolitical disruptions like we just discussed, it seems to be that there is a potential for this to also affect the flow of remittances. So in such a scenario, how do you see it unfolding, and how do you see it affecting the overall macroeconomic stability of the region?
I think that's a very vital point that you touch on, because on remittances, I think it's important to distinguish between two kinds of flows that come in. One is the relatively high-skill originating remittance inflows that come from countries of India, Pakistan, and even Nepal and Bangladesh, the relatively high-skilled professionals who have perhaps migrated to North America and the other OECD countries. So that's kind of a settled flow of remittance. But there's another very large bulk inflow of remittances that come from the relatively low to middle-skilled migrants who are mostly located in the Middle Eastern part of the world and in some countries around them, perhaps even in the African region. Now, what has been happening is that this is actually a community which is very solidly supporting the country insofar as their contributions back home are concerned. And this is one of the reasons why for a country like India, we have never seen the balance of payments getting into too much of trouble on the current account, because the remittance inflows have been really very solid. And to a large extent, they have covered India's trade gap. That has also been the case for a country like Nepal. It's been a similar case for Bangladesh. Now, the question over here is that a while ago, you mentioned about the disruption that the Red Sea is facing because of the Houthi issues. The problem is that if regional developments take a shape where the economic projects get stalled, then the requirement of labor for those projects are going to get affected. And we are talking about labor who is moving not for a permanent tenure, but more of a short-term seasonal tenure. And that is the risk. Because if these projects get stalled, we will see a seizure in the movement of migrants. And that's going to affect the inward flow of remittances. And that's not really a very good development. Because unfortunately, what happens in the South Asian region is that people have to move to jobs. Jobs don't move to people. And because people have to move to jobs, they will keep moving. If that movement gets stalled, then there is an implication on these countries in terms of what is coming in. And there are states in India, like Kerala, for example, which is heavily remittance driven and dependent. A country like Nepal is fully dependent on that volume that comes in. So yes, there are going to be obvious macroeconomic implications.
So I'd like to close off our discussion today by looking at the future outlook and situating our discussion within the broader landscape that countries in South Asia are finding themselves in. So 2024 is a year of many elections in the region. Bangladesh just concluded their elections earlier this month. We also have India and Pakistan that will go to the polls. We're also at a time where climate change and issues of sustainability are becoming more important than ever to address immediately. It also seems that the geopolitical uncertainties, both in the region as well as elsewhere in the world, will continue to affect the economic outlook of countries. Looking ahead then, what in your views should be the priorities of countries in the region in order to ensure their economic security?
I think in the first instance, there is an unhealthy tendency that is developing among the countries of the region. Not that it's just this particular region that is uniquely experienced in this. It is perhaps a tendency that is visible in certain other parts of the world as well, including in the more advanced countries. Governments are tending to become far more populist in character, and they are using public purses for pursuing those populist goals for the simple reason that employments and livelihoods are not being generated. People are getting frustrated, and South Asia is the youngest region in the world. So there is ample frustration out there from among the people. And in order to manage that frustration, governments are basically resorting to the strategy where government funds can flow out into various schemes, which are of a, you know, fixed income character. And these are not in the nature of universal basic incomes, but is there in some kinds of doles or employment supports or so on and so forth. But this could actually mean a race to the bottom, because the volumes of money with the state governments or federal governments are not endless. And what it means is that if governments tend to take these kind of stances, their ability to fight other goals, sustainable development, for example, is going to get limited, because there's not going to be enough money to be put into those programs. And the ability to generate fresh revenues will also get lost. So I hope at some stage this realization dawns upon the political community and the governments that populism ultimately has to end somewhere. It has to stop somewhere, because otherwise the bigger goals, and today there's no challenge bigger than the challenge of sustainability. And South Asia as a region and countries of South Asia individually are facing this head on. We are seeing tremendous variations in you know, extreme weather events, and the incidence of earthquakes and similar catastrophes have increased so much over the last 4 to 5 years that I think the ability of governments to fight these is really being questioned and challenged at all points in time. and the preparedness has to develop, and there are many other conditions that need to develop. One wonders whether the region is still fully prepared to address something like a second phase of a pandemic if it hits. So in short, South Asia's biggest challenge, given the volume of people that it has, is probably to ensure that it gets more disciplined in its spending habits. And that is a lesson which is to be taken forward by the governments. And whether and by what extent, you mentioned that elections are taking place in this year. These elections are all very fundamental. But there are some good lessons at the end of the day. I think the fact that a country like Bhutan has been able to move out of its LDC status is a good example. And there are other countries like Bangladesh which are waiting for this to happen. So if that graduation gets accompanied by a recognition of what is more important for the future generations insofar as supporting their existence is concerned, then I think that will be a good takeaway at the end of the day.
Dr. Palit, thanks once again for being on the podcast.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on our research, events and podcasts on social media.